Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels.
Ty Young with us. We're going to talk about the growing and protecting your wealth. He was raised in Augusta, Georgia, received a football scholarship to Georgia Tech University, where he studied industrial management, and he began his career as a cold caller at Bear Stearns & Company, and then he went on to become a financial consultant at Raymond James & Associate, and a year later at J.C. Bradford Company. And after spending many years and winning awards with major Wall Street firms, Ty founded Young Investment Advisors in 1998, and then Ty J. Young, Inc. And let's say, Ty, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, Ty, hey, thank you so much for being here. I think what we were dealing with today, we talk about growing and protecting your wealth. There are so many people who go to school. They get an academic education, or people who become entrepreneurs, they get out into the world of creativity very rapidly. But the one thing that's usually lacking is their ability to understand what finances are about, financial education. This is something that's not taught in school. How do we bypass that? How do we get to a point in this country whereby if you're going to be responsible for money, you should know what money is and how to use it?
You know, that's very, very important. It needs to be taught in schools as part of the curriculum. And it's something as a business owner or entrepreneur, it's something you need to get involved in saving for your future, early on as you begin your earning years. And it's as simple as taking one step, understanding what maybe a Roth IRA is, understanding what an IRA is, and start putting money into one of those to start planning for the future. But you hit the nail on the head. We absolutely need education. Education in our educational system on being fiscally responsible, and it wouldn't be bad if our politicians paid attention in those classes.
But when we talk about politicians today, do we have a politician, from your perspective, your point of view, looking at it from a financial end, do we have a politician today, left or right, it doesn't matter, that truly understands what we are dealing with when it comes to economy, when it comes to the budget, when it comes to spending, when it comes to saving? It seems as though we have a tremendous amount of people there running the country that are fighting to see who's right about whatever subject matter they're getting to, and they seem to forget what's going on in this country right now. We're giving billions of dollars away, and at the same time, we're not taking care of business at home.
You know, you're absolutely right about that, and I agree. There has been bad fiscal policy on both sides of the aisle, and it's gone on for years and years and years. It's not this president only. It's not the president before him only. I mean, it's literally for the last 50 years. And what we've done is, in large part, we've spent money that we don't have. We have not run the country like you and I have to run our individual households and balance our own budgets, and you know we learn very quickly in our households you can't spend more than what you're taking in, and if you do, it doesn't take long before they foreclose on your house and take your cars away. Well, the federal government has learned that they can play by different rules, and they can borrow money, they can print money, so on and so forth. But I think that there are politicians that understand what they're doing, but they choose not to deal with it because they're more interested in their political careers, and that's a sad state of affairs. It really is.
And we've lost focus. I would venture to guess, with all due respect to China, that if most people look very closely and very deep into where their mortgage is owned by the time it's been sold, resold, and sold again, we're going to find that a tremendous amount of what's owned in this country is not owned by Americans. It's owned by foreign influence, China, India, and the list goes on. Is there a stop to it? Have we really, Ty, have we gone so far that it's going to be almost impossible to get back?
You know, I don't think that it's going to be impossible to get back. All we need is a Reagan-type recovery here in the United States, a recovery where the dollar gets stronger and we cut spending and we cut regulation and we cut taxes and we allow the American entrepreneur and the American entrepreneurial spirit to take over with their ingenuity and know-how. And that, I believe, solves a multitude of problems. It happened in the 80s, and I believe it could happen again. So we're not that far off a place where we could recover nicely like we did in 1982. We just need the right economic policy, and the simple fact is it's not coming out of Washington right now.
Well, realistically, what we need is the right leaders tie to come
right
up to. Yeah, absolutely. Because when it really comes down to it, if you look at the past and you look at history, the administrations come and go. And businesses stay constant. I think that's really where it is. Politicians come and go, but business stays constant. In the case, it stays constant because it's focused on making a dollar. And that's realistically what's gone on. We've looked at how to make a dollar. You take the administration right now, the Obama, et cetera, with all due respect to Obama, but he's living the life right now. He's playing golf. He's got limousines, et cetera, et cetera. And his wife has got 20 people working for her, and it goes on and on. And at the same time, you've got people losing their houses. You got people losing their houses, and they don't even know why they lost the house. And this big flack that's going on with Bank of America right now, that the government wants to sue them because they illegally took homes away. There's such confusion up there that as long as we stay confused, it creates apathy.
This is what happens when you put, you know, college professors in charge of the country and not business owners, people that haven't run businesses and run them successfully. This administration, their economic policy is theory, to spend money. They think you can spend their way out of this mess. I mean, you can't spend your way out of debt. You've got to stop spending. Literally, it's that simple. And you're absolutely right. I think this president is tone deaf as to what's going on with the American people. And the simple fact is, he could solve a lot of this problem. This administration could solve a lot of the problems that we have in this country with a coherent energy policy. We have some of the richest reserves of energy on the planet, oil, natural gas, coal. If we would just tap into those, if we would just get the EPA, I should say, out of the way and begin to drill again and begin to mine coal at a greater level and begin to go after the natural gas, that would create, experts say, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of jobs directly and 5 to 10 million jobs or more indirectly. We would do that. That would create jobs. That would help the economy. And very importantly, we would have national security, far more national security, because we would be energy independent. That move alone could help the American people dramatically and help the American people who need the help the most. The people that need the help the most right now, the biggest number of folks that are unemployed are blue-collar minority workers. A coherent energy policy would create high-paying jobs for blue-collar workers, and that group of people who desperately need the help would get it, but we're just choosing not to do it, and I don't understand why the president wouldn't help the people in this country who desperately need the help.
Yeah, but we look at the unintended consequence, and I think everything you're saying is obviously spot on, but you give billions of dollars to Brazil so they can drill, and then we can become their customers. This doesn't make any sense whatsoever. I spent 23 years in Alaska, and I got a pretty good handle on what went on with oil. Sarah Palin, like the woman, don't like the woman, it really doesn't matter, but I watched what she did in Alaska. There's a difference between a politician and a statesman. Palin was a statesman. She got in there and she went up against the oil companies. She went up against the Republican Party and she went up against everybody. And all of the people in Alaska benefited. How did they benefit? The permanent fund dividend, which is the percentage of profit that spread through the population through the oil, the oil revenues. She increased everything. So we need people working for the people and not working for themselves in ideological bents.
You know, there's no question, and I found it to be outrageous when the president went down to Brazil, as you pointed out, and gave the state-owned oil company $2 billion, essentially, to to find oil off their continental shelf. When we have oil off our continental shelf right here, there's a whole lot of folks who need those jobs. And I agree with you. As far as Sarah Palin's concerned, she did do a great job in Alaska, and she understands the American way. She understands capitalism. I mean, what we're doing right now, what this administration's doing right now, like them or not, what they're doing is they're taking the failed socialistic policies or socialist policies from Europe and trying to put them in here and have them work. And we have Europe saying, don't do that. It doesn't work. We already know. Yet we're trying to do that. And again, it just doesn't make sense. We're doubling down on bad policy. I mean, they're going through economic advisors in Washington like they're going out of style, and the policy doesn't work. We know exactly what it takes to make the economy grow. We know exactly what it takes to create jobs and to increase tax revenue. We're just choosing not to do it. And what I'm talking about is every time we've cut income taxes, the economy's grown. Eisenhower cut taxes, the economy grew, jobs were created, tax revenue went up. JFK cut taxes. It's okay for a Democrat to cut taxes, and he did. The economy grew, jobs were created, tax revenue went up. Reagan cut taxes, jobs were created, tax revenue went up, the economy grew. Bush cut taxes. The economy grew, jobs were created, and the tax revenue went up. It's worked every time that it's been tried. If we coupled tax cuts, a flatter tax rate for Americans, cut the corporate tax, and made us more competitive with China. I mean, to me, it's unbelievable that our tax structure is such that companies will send, because of our tax structure, not because our Americans are greedy and want to get paid a lot. That's not true. Because of our tax structure, we send jobs over to China. Just a few economic tweaks, just the right economic policy would change everything. And let's look about the energy policy just a second. One thing I failed to point out a moment ago is if we had a coherent energy policy, gas prices would come down dramatically, I believe, because of consumer confidence. So these problems are not difficult to solve. You just have to stare them in the eye and solve them.
Are we dealing with, and this is really a question from your point of view, Ty, are we dealing with ideology, or are we dealing with the ability for this country to get back on its feet for everything that it was founded on? We are a capitalist country. This is the country that if you have an idea, you go out and you create it, and you can become a billionaire if you want to become a billionaire. What's gone on is we're being penalized for that. I think the real key is, my question for you is, where are we going off? When we talk about the politicians, what do they think that this country is?
You know, that's a great question. And to your question, I think we live in the greatest country in the world in the greatest time in history. And I'm an American with a capital A. I believe in this country. I believe in the entrepreneurial spirit. And I believe that if you work hard, you can make it in this country. And all the ideologicalness in the world doesn't change that. But this president and this administration, I think, by design or not, by accident or by design, is trying to squash that spirit by making this a socialistic a country. So, long story short, you know, you are either capitalist or you're socialist. You can't be a capitalist when things are good or a socialist when things are bad. You've got to pick one, and we did that in 200 years ago. So, long story short, ideology doesn't necessarily, or this president's ideas and what he's trying to get done is not going to squash the American entrepreneurial spirit. I think that the American people spoke very, very clearly November the 2nd. I think they'll speak very, very clearly the next election and the upcoming elections to turn the clock back on America, to get the America, the great America that we had, and we still have. We just got to find it again.
I would almost like to see Donald Trump take the reins for about 2 years. So the reason for that is obviously we know he's theatrical. He does what he does. But the man has made billions of dollars. The man knows how to make a business work. He knows how to deal with people. You need somebody in charge for just a couple of years to get it back to get it back solid again. You're right. We could solve our own problems right here. We could drill right here. We could create jobs right here. We could also take a look at what's going on with the illegals coming in, and we're giving them the shop. And another problem, which is very interesting, when we talk about entitlement, they're talking about Medicare, they're talking about Social Security. I paid in Social Security for X amount of years. Now, what I get out of it may not be the same value as it was 20, 30, 40 years ago because of the way the dollar has grown and the cost of things. But the point of contention is when you come down to it, there was a kid who's 25 years old, was killed. It was an African-American kid in New York. It was in the paper probably a month or so ago. The youngster had, what he had six boys and three girls. Each one was getting $1,200 and some odd a month in welfare. So when we talk about entitlement, we talk about some of the programs that are going on today, we have to sit back and look at where is this money being dispersed to? Is it just being thrown away? And for the people who really need it, look at your, give you this, the veterans coming back in that, quote unquote, are homeless, who need medical care that are not getting it. We've got all of those problems for these kids that go out and at best, they will give their life for us, and yet at the same time, somebody will sit back and just pick money up. So we've got a big problem here that somebody's got to get in and clean it up, no matter how they come at them or her, or no matter what they say about them, no matter how much they want to destroy them, somebody's got to have the guts to get in there and get this thing changed.
You know, there's no question about that. And I don't know if you saw the debate last night, but Herman Cain, I believe, was asked a question by a gentleman who might have been a doctor, and he said, I paid into Social Security and to Medicare, and I want my benefits. Why should I not get them? And the response was, again, I believe this was Herman Cain, he said, what's your response to that? He said, you know what? You were lied to. We were lied to as an American people when it comes to Social Security and to Medicare. And the simple fact is there is not enough money. There's not enough money to pay the unfunded liabilities of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So much so, if all of the American people and businesses sold everything they have, had right now, there would not be enough money to pay that unfunded liability. So obviously, we're going to have to adjust that. And as far as the welfare state that we have now 30% more people on welfare than we've ever had prior to now. And that story that you just quoted is outrageous about a 25-year-old man in New York with, did you say six children all getting $1,200 for assistance?
Ty, nine children, six girls, three boys.
Nine children. That's outrageous. We have taught a generation of people that they're entitled to this kind of money coming from the government. And those folks don't understand where that money comes from. They just feel like they're entitled to it and they're going to have it. We have got to. I agree. We have got to change that entitlement mentality of the folks that are on welfare. And don't get me wrong. I'm all for helping people who need help. Sure. But I'm not for paying people not to work. And I think you'll agree with me that we've got to elect the people who will make the tough decisions to get the folks who are sitting at home on the couch that are able to work back to work, now, by not only creating jobs but motivating them not to be on welfare but to want the American way. And you know what? That's going to take tough love, but we must do it if we're going to restore the greatness of the American people.
But if I can make a number, $2,000 a month, and I can go on welfare and get $1,500, $1,600, $1,700 a month, why should I work?
That's a great question. Here's another one. If you can collect unemployment benefits of, say, 60% of what you were making, but because you don't have the expenses of working anymore, you effectively can live the same lifestyle, why would you work?
Same. You know? I heard a very scary number the other day. The way things are looking within the next, I think, 15, 20 years, that you can't retire till 85 because you can't afford to.
Right.
So you have to keep working till you're 85 years old, and that I don't get in any way, shape, or form. But when it really comes down to it, Ty, I believe in my heart of hearts, President Obama is not stupid. He's not stupid in any way, shape, or form. This is a very smart man. Whatever.
I agree.
And in the very beginning, right before he was elected, he said he's going to fundamentally change America. He was standing in front of Acorn. He was standing in front of the unions, and he said, your voice will be heard. The man has done in that area. The man has done exactly what he said he was going to do. He's fundamentally changing this country. And if we're not very careful, we will go from socialism to becoming a third world country.
You know, it's interesting. The way they run politics already seems like a third world country. How they pick favorites, they pass Obamacare, jam it down our throat, and then give his political cronies, his buddies, 1,400 of them, waivers where they don't have to comply with Obamacare. Picking favorites like GE, didn't pay 1 cent in tax, but then marched the oil companies up to Capitol Hill and grill them on why they're making money while they're paying billions of dollars in taxes. The government's role is not to pick winners and losers like they've been doing with GM and GE, for example. Their job is to put a level playing field out there. So everybody has the same opportunity to win, so that the person that has nothing, that comes from nothing, can grow up and be a millionaire or a billionaire, as you pointed out early. That's the government's role. But we are practicing politics right now, Chicago style, and it looks like a third world country sometimes.
Yeah, no question about it. And I do believe in my heart of hearts there's still enough people here that are, you said it, I'm an American with an A also. I was born in this country in 1942. I've seen so many things happen over the years, and my goodness, it's got to come back. In one way, shape, or form, I do believe it'll come back, and we do still have the power of the vote. Ty, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. It's at tyjyoung.com, tyjyoung.com. We believe that you should have your money protected against losses in these times and receive a reasonable rate of return. That's what we do for our clients.
Wonderful. And by the way, Ty, we're going to have you back on. I think that this is something that you can't do in 20 minutes, and I would love talking to you.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Take care. Good night.
All right. Take care.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I give in.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Singita Adan coming up with us. We're going to talk about numerology.
Places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice. Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Sangeeta Anand with us. She was a senior management professional for many, many years. And then after applying her management expertise in mentoring people, she decided to extend these skills to helping people with numerology. And her management experience helped her to understand the needs of people better and address them appropriately. Helping people find their goals, directions, and missions in life is the driving force behind her success as a professional numerologist. Sangeeta, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I am good, and thank you so much for being here. Numerology is something that years back people were a little bit afraid of because they didn't understand it. And Sangeeta, I'm getting to the point of realizing that more and more people today are paying attention to the numbers, because the numbers literally mean something. So let's start out with what is numerology? Where did it come from? And then how do we use it on a practical level in our everyday life?
Sure, Michael. Well, numerology is the science of vibrations and numbers in your life graph, in a person's life graph, which is really determined by the date of birth and the name that a person is born with. The date of birth is, in fact, the blueprint, and that's because it's constant. It doesn't change. So numerology draws upon the numbers from your name and the and the date of birth, and makes assessments based on these numbers. The moment a person is born, these numbers actually begin to impact the person's life. And every number in numerology and through your life graph, there is it has a meaning and a distinct potency, which actually means that, for example, if a person is born on the first of the month, then that specific date has a specific meaning for that person, and it emits different vibrations. And, you know, vibrations are everywhere. But in case a number is missing, there is every likelihood that that person is going to feel the imbalance in life, which obviously translates into various losses for the person. Could be money, could be career, could be business, could be relationships. There are various different negative vibrations that get imbibed into the person's life. So basically, numerology actually helps to understand a person's character and, you know, draw inferences from these numbers and be able to improve a person's life. That's how it really works. Talking a little about the history of numbers and numerology, it actually the roots of numerology can be traced back to about 2,000 years when Pythagoras actually developed many mathematical theorems, and you know, he developed various ways of assessing a person's character and being able to understand how a person can improve their life. This was later refined by Sheldon and the Chinese numerology, and basically my numerology assessments is a combination of Pythagoras, Sheldon, and Chinese systems. And
let me hold you up there just for a second, because I don't want this is so. I think it's so extremely important that I don't want to let this go over somebody's head. Let's take me for an example. Let's break me down and let's talk about how I can look at the weeks and whatever. My birth date was now. I'm going to tell you my birthday, but you can't tell anybody. That's our secret. Okay.
Sure.
All right. It's 11/14/1942.
Okay. What I'll do is I'll just give you a little brief. I'll talk about just the date instead of the entire entire gamut of the date of birth as well. We'll just, you know, with your number one and number one, which is your date, it adds to number two. When you actually, in numerology, when you do an assessment, you actually take the entire total of all the numbers. However, you can make an analysis based on the basic character of a person, even by looking at the date. So you're basically a total of number two, which I would say a number two is somebody who, you know, takes that time to move on in life, and success comes gradually compared to somebody who would just be a number one, or, you know, somebody born on number 1, 10, 19th or 29th of a month, which, you know, makes them number one because they are leaders in what they do. They're really aggressive and they are go-getters and you what have you. But number two, well, I'm also a number two, but number twos are more about creating a balance in somebody's life. You know, they like to ensure that people are happy around them rather than the materialistic stuff of life, which number ones bring. So in saying that, as far as you're concerned, you're a number two. So, I mean, I would see you as a person who is not very materialistic, but somebody who is more concerned about making people happy and, you know, bringing peace to people's lives and yourself as well. So that's how I would see you as a person. Am I with you, Michael?
I'm a combination of a one and two, because I'm very aggressive. I'm very entrepreneurial. And if something pops up, I don't think about it. I just do it.
Yeah, that's because you still have single ones in your name. It's not a 2-2 as a 2-2 as in a 2-digit 20 or, you know, just a 2. So you still got two single ones there, which obviously are having that impact and making you an aggressive person. So like I said, like while the totals do come into consideration, it's also every numerical number that is considered. So, I mean, in totality, when I was to do an assessment, I would actually look at the final blueprint, which would be a total of all the numbers and assessments and, you know, then come to looking at your name and assessing the name as well. So it's really a combination of everything put together. And it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty aggressive and a pretty lengthy analysis that's done. So, I mean, to be able to say that, yeah.
So, again, let me tell you why I'm bringing this up. I'm a, my soul number is an 8 and my life path is a 5. But the key here is this, that and what you're talking about is this. Once somebody gets the numbers down and you say, okay, this is who you are, this is why you act the way you act, etc., I think the most important thing is then what comes after that. And you were talking about certain challenges and things. Based on those numbers, it'll predict the numbers that will allow you to go forward or those numbers that will challenge you. And if you understand what the challenge is, obviously you can move forward. If you can anticipate it, you can prepare for it before it happens. And if it's got to happen, the impact is less, or you know what to do and move through it as if it didn't happen.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's like a forewarning and you know exactly what's coming your way. You can prepare yourself, have a crisis management plan in place and, you know, work towards it and ensure that the impact is not as bad as it could be.
Sure. And then the other side of that, if you're running around single and you meet somebody, if you get their numbers, you'll be able to tell ahead of time if you're going to be compatible or not.
Absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head, Michael. That's exactly how it is. I mean, if you want to get into a relationship and, you know, or you are in a relationship and things aren't actually working out, but if you get your numbers assessed and you really want to know that, am I actually right for this person and are we compatible? And I mean, why are we having issues? Why are there problems? I mean, a lot of that stuff can actually be, you know, interpreted through the numbers. So you actually realize that, you know, why a certain person is the way he is. And you, once you know that, you know, you can deal with that better.
Now, by the way, numerology in and of itself. Now I know, let's say you're where are you right now?
In Auckland, New Zealand.
Okay. So physically you're in New Zealand now. See, what I think is important about that anybody who wanted to get a hold of you, if you got Skype, it's like talking to you next door and anybody can access.
Absolutely. I'm on Skype. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I have my website. I mean, I do all these readings through Facebook chat. I do it on Skype. I do it on Yahoo Messenger. I mean, I'm everywhere, literally. So there's really no difficulty in people getting readings done through me. And, you know, they just have to go through my website and get in touch. And I prearrange the times with them and stuff like that. So it's really quite convenient. I mean, it doesn't matter which part of the world you live. Because, I mean, you know, horizons have really, really narrowed now. And internet has made everything so easy. And therefore, I mean, anyone can just get in touch with me. I've got clients from the UK, the US, Europe, New Zealand, of course, Australia, Asia, Singapore, India, and all of these countries. So it really is hardly an issue now, me sitting so far away.
Now, one of the other things I think is important, and we should bring this up, it's critical. Let's say I'm a brand new entrepreneur, and I decide that I want to call my business the XYZ business, whatever the business is. But before I actually name the business, I connect with you.
Yeah.
And we start running the numbers to see if this is the name that's going to do the job. You can create a name of a business, and if the numbers aren't in sync with what you want to accomplish, you're going to have trouble all the way.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it is. I mean, you know, like I was explaining before, knowing from before what you are getting into is always very, very handy. And for example, if you know exactly the business you are getting into, and if you have a certain name in mind, you'd like to get that assessed, you know, based on the various different criteria that exist. I could actually, you know, even tell you the kind of email IDs you should have, or whether the name of the business is something that you should be opting for, or, you know, I can give you suggestions options for a better business name, you know, which would vibrate better with your date of birth and your personal name. It's a whole gamut of things that get considered. I give you a website name, you know, which is good enough, and it kind of is in harmony with your business name. So you don't have issues and, you know, minor things and minor problems. You keep wondering why my business hasn't taken off. Why is it that I'm not getting clients? But, you know, everything, when you have negative vibrations, all these things tend to get impacted. And if you know from before, you know, the line of business you are getting into, and you get it assessed and you have proper numbers names for your business, you definitely are going to remove any negative vibrations, and which means that the business will do well and your growth will be better. You get better clients. So obviously you're on the right path then.
Now, we're starting to run out of time, but I want to touch one more area. Somebody's name. I have been Michael Dresser all of my life, and we found that about a year or two ago, there were 6 or 7 or 8 Michael Dressers on the internet. So we decided to use my middle name, Michael Ray. And I became Michael Ray overnight, and everybody I've known for years started calling me Michael Ray, which is fine. But if you look at the numbers for Michael Dresser, and if you look at the numbers for Michael Ray Dresser, it's the Michael Ray that will get us more than we wanted out of what we're doing with the business, personal, and everything else. So even in the name, a little tweak in the spelling of your name could make all the difference in your life.
Absolutely, Michael. I'll give you an example. Won't go very far off. Myself, my own name. I mean, I used to spell my name earlier as S-A-N-G-E-E-T-A. And obviously for legal purposes, it still remains like that. But then having worked on myself and having known the science for a while and having done my own readings, I was well aware that, using the name with a different spelling according to my date of birth and stuff, obviously, made sense for me. And so I went and changed it to S-A-N-G-I-T-A, which is how it's spelled now. And similarly for somebody like you, where you say that, you know, you operationally you find Michael Ray working better for you. Now, I would be not be able to tell you that immediately, because obviously that means a lot of calculations. But the point I'm making is that the fact that Michael Ray obviously might have a better, vibration compared to the Michael Ray Dresser. And when we assess all these details, right, from each alphabet in your name to your date of birth, and we come to an analysis and figure out that which name really works better for you and will give you a best impact in the way you live. And obviously, as you say that for you at the moment, Michael Ray works better for you. But I would say that I would have to do a proper analysis before I could actually say that. But the gist of the whole thing is that definitely corrections and spelling names and changes in a name are really important. If a person's name is not in harmony with their date of birth, there's no point holding on to that name, because you might just be wondering why things don't work out. But when you change your name, the things slowly and gradually start impacting your life in a positive way. That's because you can't change your date of birth, because that's your blueprint for life and you've been born with it. But you can make changes to your name, because there's nothing to stop you from changing your name. So when to get your name in harmony with that date of birth, you can make certain changes. And I definitely recommend people to get their names assessed and get them corrected, because a lot of people don't know that. And they actually realize the difference when they've changed the names. Of course, the ideal impact comes if you legally make all those changes, but even minor changes are helpful. If you don't want to go around making changes with your passports and other bank documents, but you can start with basic things like email IDs and, your business cards and stuff like that. I mean, all of this has an overall impact, and you begin to start feeling better. That's because you're imbibing positive vibrations into your life.
Sangeeta, we're starting to run out of time. Now, how do we get a hold of you? How can we find you?
Well, like I mentioned before, Michael, I'm pretty much everywhere on every social media. My website is www.expertsangeetaanand.com, which is S-A-N-G-I-T-A-A-N-A-N-D. And I'm on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Sangeeta Anand. I'm on Facebook as well, numerologist Sangeeta Anand. So I'm easily available for anybody who wishes to contact me.
Wonderful. Sangeeta, thank you so much. You're absolutely delightful, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Michael. You have a great one.
Good night.
Good night. And a love who's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And as a matter of fact, well, we can figure it out. And Seth, the genie of the board there, the engineer, has told us how to do it. And one day we'll get it. There is actually a chat room that you could use. And if there's something that you wanted to say during the show, it's easy to do. And we're going to talk about something very interesting. Aaron Lapidus is with us. He is the author of The Garage Sale Millionaire. He's America's number one collector, has many literary and business accomplishments to his credit. In addition to being an award-winning author, Aaron is a Denver Post columnist on the subject of collecting and collectibles and is an esteemed lecturer at Colorado Free University in Denver, Colorado. His latest book, The Garage Sale Millionaire. Let's say, Aaron, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. That's a great intro. I may have to have you intro me on everything that I come in on to go speak to.
My pleasure. My goodness. Aaron, when you really come down to it, the garage sale millionaire, there are so many people who do not understand what a garage sale truly is. And there's so much that can be done in something like that, that's just underneath the surface. Let me ask you this: what was it that caught your attention, turned that light bulb on to research this particular subject, and then write the book?
It was actually 2 years ago when I was watching CNN. I was seeing people losing their job by the hundreds and thousands. And I kind of believed that, you know, there had to be a way that people could make money to make ends meet, and it had to be right in front of them. And then I realized what I did when I was 7 years old, and I had garage sales. And my parents said if I wanted anything, I had to make my own money. And so we had our first garage sale, and I got addicted ever since. And I put on 50 of them, and I just learned that if I wanted something, I had to figure out a way to pay for it, and having garage sales was an easy way to do it.
So in essence, and I think this is something to bring up, somebody hears garage sale. All right, you throw a bunch of things out there and then you try to sell something. But obviously we can look at it from both ways, those selling and those buying. But the most important thing is garage selling, from what I'm seeing, and I'm looking at your press material, it's a process. It's an actual system, and if you've got it down, you can make money at it.
You know, it doesn't have to be as difficult. A lot of people think garage sale and think that they have to put in 2 full days and they have to put in 2 weeks to get ready. I believe that in a couple days and putting on a garage sale for only one day, you can have a great garage sale and make, you know, several hundreds of dollars and not putting in all the work that people think you need to do. You just have to work smart and not hard.
I think that's basically what I was saying when it really comes down to it. It's knowing what to do. When I say a process, working smart is a process. And if you can tell somebody what to do and the way to do it. Now, doing a garage sale. Now, most of the people will get out and they'll throw things out there and they'll stand around and they'll hope somebody will come up. What do you do to get their attention, number one? And number two, once you've got them there, how do you work it?
I recommend using social media. You know, when I started, we didn't have things like Facebook and Craigslist. Now we do. So I recommend a week out that we put an ad on Craigslist, and then we let all our Facebook friends know about it. And then when we get a little closer, we do about 20 big signs, whiteboard signs with red pen, and we tell people the exact date and some of the nice things that we're going to have. Some of the big things that people want to see: baby furniture, garden furniture, antiques, tools. Those are big ticket items that people are always looking for. So we put the 20 signs around the neighborhood, like around libraries and food markets, and then we kind of channel the people to our garage sale. And that's the important thing. The more people that show up, the better chances are to sell and make a lot of money.
Okay, now, so we've got everybody out there. It's like the big party that you're going to have, and you open the door and nobody comes, and they don't come because nobody told them that there was a party. So I think the front advertising is great, which most people don't do. Now, do you have to learn how to sell an item? And when I say that, most people stand there and somebody will walk up, they'll ask them a question, and they'll, what about this? And they don't sell it. What they do is they give them a little information because they really have no, again, process behind what they're doing. Is there any way to sell it? Is there any way to actually offer it to somebody coming in whereby when they come in and look at it, they're going to walk out with it instead of saying, oh, that's nice, and 15 people look at it, and maybe somebody will buy it?
You know, when your garage sale have it at 9 a.m., good chance people are going to show up at 8. I call them the garage sale groupies. You're not going to really have to sell your items. They're going to show up, and they're going to want to buy them. So for every piece of item that you have, there's probably somebody out there that wants it. So I wouldn't really stress about people, you having to be that great salesperson. You need to negotiate, though, because you're going to say $10, they're going to say $3. So you need to be prepared to negotiate and come to a happy medium, or else you'll sell it for two less, or you won't sell it at all. So that's the more important thing, not so much to stress out, you know, how do I be this great salesperson? So that's my recommendation.
Now, I remember it was, back in 1986, 87, I was up in Fairbanks, Alaska, and the market crashed, basically, and people's homes were going, and it wasn't quite as bad as it was now, but there was a pretty good financial crunch, and people were holding their money back, and garage sales were all over the place. I mean, every other house had a ton of stuff with garage sales, and what I saw there when I went through a lot of that, as I walked through, I thought, my goodness, look at the money that you can save in a garage sale. You buy a great couch that somebody's had for a few years. They have to go for some reason. And that great couch that you can pick up for a couple $300 may have cost you $1,000, $1,500 in the store. So all of that is there. It works good both ways. One is, if you have things that are going to sit around, make a few dollars. The other side of that is, if you're going to go in there and you're going to buy something, the tremendous discount that you can get on a particular item as opposed to paying for it retail.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, people, the charm and the interest and the excitement of actually stopping at garage sales is because there's so many great treasures. And a lot of people have garage sales and just want it gone. And that's the garage sale you want to be at, but that's not the garage sale you want to put on. You want to make sure when you're putting stuff out that you know what it's worth. You want to be in control. So many people put a whole bunch of stuff on their front lawn, and their goal is just to get it gone. Well, you know, there's a lot of items. The reason why I became rich is because people didn't take the time on finding out what items are worth. And that is very, very important. for you to, when you have your next garage sale, that you find out what everything's worth. You find out what that router that you don't use anymore is worth, that antique stool that your grandmother gave you. You find out what these things are worth, because that's how you're going to make the most amount of money in the less amount of time.
Well, no question about it. And one of the things in your press release, which I think is critically important, is about how to stay away from the items with little or no value and steer to those items that have the hidden gems, the treasured finds. How do you tell the difference between the two?
You know, a lot of, when you're having a garage sale and you have a lot of inexpensive items and you don't want to waste the time on selling everything, you know, every item for a nickel, you put them in a box, and then you say, everything in this box, $10. That's the way to save. That's the way of saving time and getting rid of a lot of things quickly. That's not going to garner you much money. Now, if you are going to a garage sale, the same thing kind of applies. You need to look at an item and make sure that you're looking at something that is not a replica. It's not old and dusty, and it just looks very old, like an antique, because a lot of times people see items that have no value, and they, just because they're a little rusty or something like that, they get confused and they buy them anyway. So that's you have, when buying, take your time. And also, I always suggest you bring a smartphone, because a lot of times the things that you're looking at a garage sale have been sold on eBay. And I always recommend use eBay as a reference, because good chance it's on eBay and has been sold on eBay several times.
Now, by the way, you're also an expert for the FBI. Imagine that if you got into what you're doing now, I imagine there are some things that go on in garage sales that shouldn't go on, or are you an expert in another field?
No, that's my field, but I've never been called by the FBI by a wayward garage sale. So usually on the FBI will bring me in if there's being fakes, you know, art is being forged or sports memorabilia, and then I have to be called in to see how this gets handled. Is it a civil matter or is it a criminal matter? As to what not to sell at garage sales, people have to be aware of, if you're in a state that has strict gun laws, you shouldn't be selling any kind of weapons, because that could get you in trouble. That includes fireworks, that includes ammunition. People think that they can sell food. Believe me, people sell almost anything. Know what the rules are when you're having a garage sale, because you could get in trouble. So that is my criminal side, to help people know that there could be violations. Do it wrong. Most items are for sale and won't cause anybody any problems. Yeah. But if you cross the line and sell an item like a firearm, you will get in trouble.
By the way, I think this is critically important, that the window of opportunity for the book now and the subject matter, summer is just beginning. That's the time for garage sales. They're going to be all over the place. And realistically, if you're going to have one, I had this thought in my mind when you're saying FBI, of having a garage sale and watch the SWAT team pull up. Not a good idea. But when it comes down to it, there are some rules to a garage sale. Not necessarily unbendable rules, but ideas that you're talking about, things that you do, the bag when you throw things in, $10 for the box of whatever. Those things are critical, and I imagine that if you really came down to it, this is the thought that I had. I'm going to go out and do a garage sale. So I sell things, but then I go to all the different garage sales and I find items that I like and I buy them and I come back and I resell them. I mean, there's all kinds of things that you could do with this.
A lot of people, this is their job. This is what they do. They will go. That's why I recommend to people and to you, because I hopefully after this conversation, you're going to get the bug and want to have a garage sale. So that you never sell anything that you don't know the value on, because people like me will go to your garage sale and buy it and then either have another garage sale and sell it for more money or put it on eBay. So you bring up a great point that a lot of people do this as a job, but you don't want people to come to your garage sale and be able to make money off of you. So that's why I give that tip.
Now, by the way, when you mentioned know what the worth of something is, there is a train set sitting down in my basement And I mean, the thing is, it's got to be worth a lot of money. How do you find out what those things are worth?
Okay, that is a great question. So you go to, with train sets. So they made a lot of, is it a Lionel train set?
Yeah, it's a Lionel.
Great. So on the boxes, say what gauge it is, and which tells you the size and everything like that. So you would go on to eBay, and you would type in Lionel in a certain gauge, and it would, or the serial number of it, and it will pop up all those trains that are being sold on eBay. So you find the train. And so now you know the exact train. Then you go on the left-hand side of eBay on the screen. There's an area called completed items. Now, this is powerful. You go into completed items, and it will tell you what that train has sold for in the last 90 days. Now you have a value that I consider is a fair market value for that train. So if that train all day long is averaging $350, then you should be selling your train for around $350. Now, what will change the value is, do you have the original box? Is the train in good condition? These are things that will fluctuate the value. But now you have an idea, and a lot of people will sell these 50-year-old Lionel trains, 60-year-old Lionel trains, for $10, $15, when they're really worth several hundreds of dollars. The caboose and the engine are big items, whether they're in the box or not. And the more stuff that you have to go with the train, the more value. So that is my tip.
Okay. Now, if you don't have the box, would you find the serial number on one of the items, like the caboose, like the engine, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. You turn it over. A lot of collectibles, if you flip it over on its belly, and you're careful with it, obviously, you don't want to hurt it, but you gently turn it on over, it will give you the serial number or the title of that collectible, and that is the way you find it. So you don't need to have the packaging to get all the information, and you don't need the packaging to you don't lose all the value of an item, but it does add value if you have a packaging to any of the collectibles that are out there these days.
Wonderful. And if the thing sells for thousands, you got a piece of it.
Yeah, that's what I ask. You know, I tell people when they get my book, The Garage Sale Millionaire, that if they make whatever they make, I get 10%. I have to tell you, I'm still waiting on my first check.
Oh, I was going to give you 20, but 10's okay. Aaron, we're about out of time. And it's not just the train. There's so many things like that you can get information from. Website we can find you at and buy the book.
TheGarageSaleMillionaire.com. They can go right to my website and buy the book, or they can go to Amazon.com. And if they go to my website, I give a free garage sale checklist. All they have to do is go to my website, and they get this free list that's sent to them and gives them all the things they need to know to have their own garage sale and makes them really easy. And I hope after this conversation, I hear about your garage sale and how successful you are.
That's all I got to say. Aaron, thank you so much. I really appreciated your time. This has been fun.
Thank you very much for having me on tonight.
Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star, brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
To have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Said don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Alan Hunter with us, the author of The Path of Synchronicity, Align Yourself with Your Life's Flow. And as a matter of fact, I think those words in and of themselves say a tremendous amount. Alan was born and educated in England, living in Surrey and Oxfordshire before moving to Boston and becoming a naturalized American citizen. And growing up, he lived in Belgium, Italy, Sardinia, and Madagascar, as well as England. And he received his doctorate at Oxford University in literature with a focus on Joseph Conrad. Now, he's the author of 10 books, including two about the therapeutic uses of writing. And the books are tremendous, and I want to make sure we get enough time with Alan. So, Alan, hi, welcome to the show.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Michael. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here, Alan. You know, when we talk about synchronicity, I know you've traveled the globe, and with all of your searching and looking and researching, where was it that you realized when the light bulb went on that synchronicity was really the bridge of coming together?
Well, synchronicity is one of those wonderful things that keeps nudging you until you pay full attention to it. And so it's one of those things where when you look back on it, as I think Schopenhauer actually said, when you look back on your life and you begin to think about how you got to where you are now, you begin to see how many strange coincidences there are and there have been that have brought each individual to where he or she is. And for me, I think actually the moments when this happened, I can't remember the precise moment, but I can remember when I was thinking about it, was when I was wandering around collecting stories just for my own interest on people who had been married for a long period of time and been happily married. And I asked them, how did you know? And in every case, and I kept, you know, asking people, in every case they were able to say, well, you know, I did this and I met this person and I just knew. And I thought, gosh, that's rather unusual. But what it was telling me over and over again, because I had a similar experience in my own life, what it was telling me is that if we're open to what the world is sending us, rather than closed and determined only to take what we think we expect, if we're open, sometimes these moments of knowing hit us, and that's a type of synchronicity, when you know this is where I'm supposed to be.
That aha moment.
What's supposed to happen.
Yeah, Alan, it's that aha moment. I think the path of synchronicity, align yourself with your life's flow. The greatest analogy that I've ever heard regarding that, and when I read the tagline, it hit. It was if you were body surfing down a river and there was a big stone in the middle of the river. Now, if you resist the current, you're going to insert yourself into the stone. But if you just relax and quote go with the flow, you're going to go around the stone. And I think that's really it. It's called stop resisting and allow yourself to accept the challenges that are put in front of you.
What a beautiful example that is, because that's exactly what happens. If you fight the flow, you'll almost certainly wind up against the rock because the current wants to go around the rock. And so many people fight the flow that is in their lives for whatever reasons, usually reasons that have to do with thinking that things ought to be otherwise. And that makes us miserable, and it invites us out of the place of synchronicity. So that's a wonderful example, Michael.
Now, by the way, Alan, when we talk about listening to others, and I think that's critically important, because if we listen to others, it's their perfection, their ideas, their synchronicity, quote-unquote, that you're trying to match up to, and it's never going to happen. I think that's the major mistake that most people make. I can't live your life through my existence, because no matter what I do, I'm going to be the second best Alan.
That's exactly it, yes. And, you know, unfortunately, so much of this loving advice which is wrong advice, comes from people that we respect. It comes from parents who want us to be something, siblings who want us to be something else, bosses, society, what we see on the TV. But whilst we're doing that, we are, as you say, becoming second-rate versions of ourselves. And what we have to be, I think, is true to what we feel to be our truth and where we're being taken. And if we listen to that, it will take us where we need to go, which might not be the same place as where we imagined we would be at age, you know, 10, 15, or 20, but it will be the place we need to be. And that's the importance of synchronicity.
And I think it's critical also, and an example happened to me years ago. I was doing a workshop, and I jumped on a chair, and I looked at the audience, and I said, describe me. And I got everything from your wonderful, loving, nurturing individual to your self-centered, egotistical son of a yada, yada, yep. And I said, what are you talking about? They said, you. And I said, whoa. They were projecting. And I think that's the major problem. If somebody finds a fault with you, they want you to do something better. They're not talking about you. They're talking about them. And we never make that distinction, and we get stuck.
We get stuck, exactly. That's a marvelous example. I could perhaps add one to that, and that is John Steinbeck, the Nobel Prize-winning novelist. He knew he had to be a writer, and as a young writer, he thought, well, what do I do that'll make me famous? And he looked at the book market, and he decided that historical fiction set in the 17th century was going to make him famous. So he wrote these four huge books, he tells us in his memoirs, and nobody wanted them. And then he said, oh, the heck with this, he said. I'm going to write about what's right in front of me. And what was right in front of him were the poor people of California. And once he started writing those stories, what was in front of him, what he cared about, what he saw every day, what really moved him, that's when his writing career took off in a big way. And I think the lesson there is, for all of us, don't try to be what you think someone else thinks you should be. Do what is authentically you.
Yeah, and one of the problems that we have with that, and I can see this in so many people, and it's taken a lot of years to learn this, obviously. I wasn't born with it, but it's taken enough time to watch, go through my own stuff and watch other people, is that when it comes down to it, when people are frightened to death of making a decision because of what they think somebody else is going to think. What I finally learned over all the years was it's all a learned response. So if you can learn something, Alan, you can unlearn it, and you can relearn a different alternative to it. And I think that's really where it is. You talk about the shadow. What is the shadow?
Well, the shadow is actually exactly what we're talking about here, and that is as we go through life, you know, as we grow up, as we're socialized, we're told to quash all those feelings that are not acceptable. So anger, destructiveness, rage. If you're a man, you're told to be more manly and be less interested in perhaps the more feminine side of oneself. And by crushing that down in order to fit in, we're doing exactly what you describe. But unfortunately, we're cutting ourselves off from about 50% of our resources, and we're using a huge amount of energy to do that, because there are rage is a bad thing, of course. It can get out of hand, but it's also a vital part of ourselves, and we have to use it. And I mean that sincerely, because if you think of Martin Luther King, you know, nonviolence, that was the tenet that he lived by. But he was questioned very closely. He said, well, what happens, that people asked him, what happens if you find yourself being opposed violently? And his response was quite simple, and that is, if you understand your own shadow, your own desire to respond to violence with violence, if you can understand that, then you don't have to get into a fight. You can use that righteous rage, perhaps, in order to make sure the other person doesn't hurt you, or the other people don't hurt you further. And in that way, you use the shadow energy positively. And that's something that many of us have yet to understand, because we're so busy, as you so rightly say, trying to fit in, trying to do things, trying to be nice, and we cut ourselves off from this prodigious source of energy, the energy that really does allow us to be authentic and help the world to be a little better, even if we're not Martin Luther Kings, you know, well, even if we're not. I could give you another example. In my counseling practice, I sometimes come across parents who are terrified of being too strict with their children. And so they're not strict at all because they're afraid that they will seem angry to their children. And to which I say, well, you know, sometimes you have to say no to a child for his or her own good. That's the nature of parenting. You can't be everybody's friend and be a successful parent and bring up a good child. And so by cutting themselves off from their sense of perhaps outrage, which of course every child is going to annoy us at some point, but by not being able to trust that they can contain that and use that shadow energy, children run out of control and do themselves no benefit at all, and that's when we have very, very dysfunctional families.
By the way, I'm listening very closely to what you say, and I think what I would do with the path of synchronicity, align yourself with your life's flow. I think I would add something to that. And I would say align yourself with your life's flow, the path to permission. And I think that's really where it is. We're frightened to death, Alan, to give ourselves permission to be a certain way, to feel a certain way, and to have a certain thing. We look for permission outside, and that's where the conflict and the challenges start, because permission comes from within. You've got to be able to give yourself permission to do whatever you want in life.
Yes, yes. I like that very much. I mean, yes, we look for permission as opposed to giving ourselves our own permission to be who we are. And certainly, if we go back to my example of parenting, you know, the best gift we can ever give to a child is to be authentically ourselves.
Sure.
So that the child can learn from what we do and be authentically him or herself. That's the finest gift. But yes, you're absolutely right. It has to do with changing the permission that we often seek from the world into giving ourselves our own agency. And that's very different.
Oh, sure. We're running out of time now, but I really believe if my mom was still alive and I was sitting here the age that I am now, and I'm not a youngster, and she said, "You get in here right now," I'd probably just jump up and move without thinking. But that's what parents are about. They're not your friend. They're the ones that will teach your survival, and that's really what it's about. Alan, let me ask you this. Website we can find you at, please.
Yes, it's www.alan.hunter.net.
Don't go to .com,
it's an Australian footballer.
Alan, can we buy the books on the website?
Yes, you can on the website. You can also get The Path of Synchronicity on Amazon.com, which is probably most people know that best. But you can buy the books on the website or go to Findhorn Press. There's a link from the website to both of these places.
Wonderful. Dr. Alan Hunter, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for including me. It's been a great pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places. Mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is. So why stay there? And there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply interested. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I think of the warm Caribbean. I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just
to. Tom Grazo, but this is the co-author of Turbocharged: Accelerate Your Fat Burning Metabolism, Get Lean Fast, and Leave Diet and Exercise Rules in the Dust. He and his sister have been spent 30 years now working directly with renowned scientific researchers studying health, exercise, longevity, and stress management. They're the co-authors of Turbocharged. Again, accelerate your fat-burning metabolism, get lean fast, and leave diet and exercise rules in the dust. And let us say, Tom, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael Ray, thank you very much for having me.
And by the way, did I pronounce your name right? I hope I did.
Well, Grissel.
Grissel, okay. Can I do the entire intro again?
No.
No, okay. we're good. I will never. I've got it down pat now. It's Tom Grissel. Tom, that's where great. Was it that? And I have to go back 30 years. Where was it that you got interested in this? You researched it. You became part of it with the programs. What was it that caused you and your sister to get involved here?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly when it started. I was always, health and fitness were always a passion of mine, and I always, I always just was fascinated with it, and read books forever. And then my younger sister, had the same sort of desire. And, so early on we started to collaborate. She went on to get a PhD in nutrition. Over the years, we were always reading, experimenting, trying virtually every new diet that came out. That was kind of the beginning.
Now, by the way, when we look at this, and this is directly from your press release, because I think it's critical to lay the base, diets and fitness programs and personal trainers and drugs and supplements and weight loss gadgets to choose from. There are so many people that are so confused today. They start a program, a regime, and then they get to a certain point and they quit and they gain all the weight back, or they get out of shape, and it goes on and on and on. And it seems as though everybody keeps coming back to square one and they haven't found that certain something. I've met people that have had the gastric bypasses that a year later they've gained weight, and some people have actually committed suicide. So what do we do? What's that bridge to be able to get across to getting what you want and being able to deal with it once you get there?
Yeah, well, that's so true. And that's the reason why we wrote the book. Statistically right now, over 30%, Center for Disease Control says that 34% of the American population of adults is obese. And another survey said that 70% of Americans feel that they need to lose weight and are on some sort of a diet. But with all of the gyms and all of those other things.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
Fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Our guest, a former cardiac and emergency room nurse with 20 years experience, diet nurse Connie Huff, BSN RN, is the ultimate champion for frustrated, desperate, overweight souls her Rejuvenate Your Body, Free Your Life program is the result of an in-depth study of the physiology of fat loss and the biology of fat storage and fat utilization. Connie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. After a 40-year pattern of struggle and epic diet failure, you finally found the way to do it. You lost 80 pounds. Where was it? What was it that you found that was working, that was that bridge beyond everything else that you've tried?
Well, one of the things was that, I came to a pinnacle in my life where I realized myself that I was extremely unhealthy. And at 40 years of age, I was facing diabetes, heart disease, cancer within a couple of years if I didn't do something. So what I did is I began to look at people who were lean and also retain their muscle, but yet knew how to get lean and stay healthy. So I began to really study those types of people and study what they were doing and what they were eating, because obviously they had some tricks up their sleeves that we did not know. The average dieter just goes from diet to diet to diet, and you just end up more fatter and more frustrated. So what I did is I began to study those types of people, and what I discovered is that what they were doing was actually pretty easy, and they ate all the time, which was another thing that shocked me, because, you know, I was a starver. I tried to stay away from food, and that was a huge problem. So
you know,
we addressed those kind of things.
That's a really tough way to go when somebody tries to stay away. The worst thing I think anybody can do to themselves with any subject, any matter that you're dealing with, is to deny yourself. The minute you deny yourself something, the problems start. And if you really want to know what your stuff is about food, chain up the refrigerator and watch what comes up. But I really believe that it's when you deny where the problems start, because then the fight begins.
Sure. And, you know, the problem in our society right now is that we've never seen the types of food, our bodies have never seen the types of food that we're consuming. You know, if you study eons past, we've never had this literal glut of nutrient deficiency, and our bodies are very complex structures. You know, you've got a body that consists of 100 trillion cells, 600 muscles, over 100 hormones, 62,000 miles of blood vessels. Do you really think it's going to, you know, obey one simple rule to lose belly fat?
No.
The body just thinks that's so bogus, and yet what we do is we expect to take a diet product, and we just automatically assume that there was some real science behind it, and
happens. Isn't it the difference between diet and nutrition? Everybody's out there on a diet, and diets really don't work anymore. From what I'm hearing you say, it's really about nutrition, isn't it?
It is 100% nutrition, and it has to be 100% about eating. You eat to gain fat, you eat to lose fat. But there's certain things you eat to gain fat, and there are certain things you eat to lose fat. So it is 100% eating. If you want to lose weight, you have to eat. But you have to know what to eat and when to eat and how much to eat. It's not this little simple method that people think, because everybody's a unique individual and everybody has completely different lifestyles. So it really has to be customized to fit you.
Okay, so it's very individual. Let's define something. Let's take the word fat. What is fat? What actually is fat? What's the purpose of it?
Well, fat actually is a wonderful, wonderful organ in the body, and it's actually an endocrine system unto itself. It's not just this blubber that hangs there and does nothing, because we've thought that that's what it was in the past, but we're finding out that fat has many, many roles in the body, and it actually has many functions. It produces certain hormones. It produces certain neurotransmitters and chemicals. It's a fascinating subject, but fat is just a really unique, highly concentrated form of energy. And the body can break it down and use it either as fat or as glucose. It's absolutely phenomenal what the body can do with fat. And it's there to protect us. It's not there to harm us. Your body loves you. So when it's gaining fat, it's trying to protect you from something. And so there's something wrong when you're gaining too much fat.
I spent some time in Alaska, some 20-some-odd years. And if you go up to the native villages, there's something called muktuk. Muktuk is whale blubber. And during the wintertime, which there's 8 months of winter, and it could get to be 40, 50 below zero, they load up on this stuff because it does protect your body. And isn't that what the body does if there's an emotional problem, physical problem, if the body gets threatened in some way, it protects itself and it loads up on fat. And I would venture to guess if you look underneath most people's bodies, when you've got all of this excess weight, there's an emotional something beyond that that drove it in the first place, because a lot of it is pure protection.
The emotional cascade that happens in the body chemically, because it's not just an emotion when you're sad or you're crying or you're depressed. That actually causes a complete chemical cascade in the body. And what that does is it ends up really pushing on those adrenal glands, which everybody knows what the adrenal glands are. They're your fight or flight. They're your stress-inducing hormones, which are wonderful if you think your boss is a tiger and he's attacking you. That's what your body perceives, but you are saying, well, no, my boss is just a jerk. But your body perceives him as a tiger, and in the past, we would have run or fought that tiger. But instead, we just simmer in our juices and just, I don't like my boss. I don't like what's going on here at this company. And so we never do anything with those wonderful chemicals that were there to protect us. And so the problem becomes then is that those chemicals actually end up doing severe damage when they're not released in the proper manner. And so that ends up blocking any fat burning going on. It actually damages the cell at the cellular level, so you can't function hardly at all. So yeah. Stress is a huge
so understand this. Let's go back to the adrenals and the stress-induced hormone, which create the stress-induced hormones. Let's say you got that boss of yours you don't like, you feel threatened. You got a sympathetic nervous system that's going to, you know, jump in. There's your fight or flight. You've got the sympathetic and parasympathetic. You got the sympathetic.
Yep.
It's going to kick it in. That's going to protect you. And then when you feel comfortable, the parasympathetic is going to release certain chemicals and balance you out on homeostasis. Without that parasympathetic, you'd go crazy. So the body has its ability to level itself, but it has to know when to do it. And if you, like what you're saying, which I think is critical, if you begin to understand your own body chemistry, you can control it. And now all of a sudden things are intentional instead of accidental. It's a quick, if you're really angry, and you force yourself to smile, you're going to get a quick dopamine squirt, and you'll feel better immediately. So it's controlling the chemicals.
Oh, I love it. You know your body. This is great. I love it because, you know, people just don't understand. You live in your body for 75 years at least. Don't you think it's time that you begin to at least just scratch the surface to understand it? You know, and what people do with when they have a confrontation with their boss or they're frustrated or they're in a hopeless or helpless situation at work is then they continue to just pound on their adrenals like little slave drivers, and they'll drink a cup of coffee and they'll slam down a donut or something unhealthy for them that has no nutrient value, and then continue to just whip their adrenal glands with something like that. So just learning one small little piece of how to learn how to react to these things will help you reduce your stress levels, which in turn will help you become so much healthier. You'll be able to lose fat a lot easier, and you'll be able to have a much healthier life in the long run.
What's critical also, and you've got it in your press release, which I think is very important, the medical profession run by the pharmaceutical industry, doctors are taught antiquated research. You know, you get into allopathic medicine, the chemicals, et cetera. The pharmaceutical industry runs it because if you, quote unquote, if you follow the money, what you're going to do is you're going to find out why we end up the way that we end up. There's billions of dollars to be made in the not the wellness industry, but the sickness industry. And if they can keep you fat, they can keep money going on. If they get the McDonald's and the rest of it, and this is going to be good for you, you'll feel good when you eat this, and you get pressured you follow what they have to say, and you end up 240 pounds and frumpy. I know somebody who was like that.
Oh, well, you know what most people don't understand is that drugs by law, medicines, do not have to be proven to be safe.
Yeah.
They only have to show the potential benefits. The potential benefits are going to outweigh the side effects. That's it. And so, yeah, you know, when you see those long lists of side effects on those drug commercials, there's a reason they do that. But they also are presenting you with, you know, a case study of somebody who was not cured, but their symptoms improved. And there you have this sign right there. They're looking for symptom improvement. That's it. Not a cure, just symptom improvement. That's it.
But there's no oversight.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay, there's no oversight over the pharmaceutical industry. And when something says, you know, FDA approved, et cetera, it wasn't FDA approved. It was approved by the pharmaceutical industries, handed to the FDA. The FDA puts a stamp on it, and they sell it.
Amen, brother. You know, there's another thing. By law, there's nothing to prevent a close association between scientists who work for the government or universities. They can also work closely with the pharmaceutical or food industries. So here you have the richest sector of the drug and food industries, which produce the designer drugs and the very low nutrient density foods, like all the sugary stuff and the diet product stuff. And they're the ones literally backing the research, which, in my opinion, is just biased and unconscionable. And, you know, unfortunately, we're finding a lot of fraud and, you know, some of the institutions overlooking the quality of this quote-unquote quantifiable research is questionable, and they omit a lot of findings. And so it's kind of like findings by omission. Well, we don't like these numbers, so we'll just omit those, and then we'll place in the numbers that we want. So it's really not reputable research that we're getting right now.
Now, by the way, if I get the Rejuvenate Your Body, Free Your Life, if I get that, will I learn how to decode my body, get my body type, be able to do the things I need to get my body to where it's supposed to be?
100%. Like I said, you know, the key to it is literally having it be yours, because you're not like anybody else. Your life isn't like anybody else. Your genetics isn't like anybody else. So unless you literally find out what your core metabolic problems are and then decode what kind of body you have, then you've got a starting point. Because then you know what problems you're going to have to overcome. You know what kind of body, you know, you're going to be the type of person that is going to have to need more protein than the other guy, or the other guy is going to need more carbohydrates than you. But once you know what parameters that you have to work in, then that becomes so much easier. And we teach that in my program. So it is so customizable. I mean, it's customized specifically to you. So I'm actually giving you what the expert trainers and fitness instructors actually do for people. It's literally all those types of formulas. So how, in it, step by step. So it just breaks it down really nicely and easily. So you can just go through it and just go, oh, this is what I am. This is what I am. This is what I need. So it's very customizable.
Now, by the way, I saw the before and after pictures of you, the 240-pound frump to the hot bikini contestant. Now, I saw the pictures. The pictures are absolutely remarkable. There's no question about it. But when somebody loses weight, you don't have to have a competitive body. Now, the competitive body took bodybuilding, took weights, took, you know, various things, which if somebody wants to do it, they can obviously do it. But the weight loss, I think, is the most critical thing for most people. If I was 5'8" and I was 220 pounds, but if I was a bodybuilder and all that was muscle, it'd be a whole different story, because muscles will create weight. And I really think people are trying to lose weight. It's called, how do you want to look, get a picture of it, and then move towards that.
Yeah, we really focus on body composition versus the scale. The scale is a gross measurement, and it's not only gross by looking at it, but it's gross in the fact that it cannot distinguish between fat, muscle, water, bone, organs. It just can't. It just gives you a gross measurement. And so if you have somebody who's ripped and muscular, like you said, at 220 pounds, who cares what the scale says?
Sure.
Versus the couch potato at 220 pounds.
Now, by the way, I have this joke around here. I was for my birthday, my sister bought me a scale, and I'm on it every 20 minutes. Now, there is the I Hate Michael Ray fan club that's all over the country, and it's actually getting to be all over the world now. I'm one of those kind of people that can eat three meals, two desserts, and lose a half a pound the next morning.
Yes, we hate you. You can add my name to the list.
It's so easy to get the fan club going if you want to, because if you experience, you could be a chairperson.
Okay. We call a genetically elite individual.
Yeah, but it's true. I have to be careful that I don't lose weight. So I'm on the scale 2-3 times a day to make sure I stuff myself so I keep the weight up. And it's good and it's fun, and I am hated for it, but other than that, it works. but you can be in any way that you want to be. I happen to have a very fast metabolism, and even though I'm stuck around a telephone or whatever, I am moving constantly all day. I'm doing stuff. And if I'm not sitting at my desk working with somebody, I have in the studio and everything else, there's a gym about 4 feet away from me with all the stuff in it. So that's just my lifestyle.
Wonderful. And people can learn from that. You know, you have over 600 muscles in your body. So we were made to move. We should be moving. We aren't just supposed to sit there and do nothing. You are made to move, and we need to move those muscles. And you're right, you don't have to be a bodybuilder at all. What I did is because that's how I decoded my body. I was very much already had the natural muscle, and so I just expanded upon that. Where somebody else is going to be a runner, or somebody else is going to be a gymnast or a dancer. So it's finding out what's right for each individual. And then just expanding on those gifts and talents, that's the fun part. Because once you figure that out, you're like, I don't have to fit into this little corner.
Yeah, and you had the body to begin with, even though it was hiding underneath the weight.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't, it's never going to happen for you. I don't care what you do with it. Connie, we're running out of time. Is there a website we can find you and also get a hold of the program?
Yeah, would love it if you went to eliminatefatnow.com. There's a blog there. I've got all kinds of great articles and giveaways. You can also sign up. I give away a free core metabolic makeover every month, so you can sign up there. Also, you can go to myhelpmeloseweight.com, where you can sign up for that free core metabolic makeover. Plus, we're giving away a grand prize every quarter, so definitely want to sign up for that.
Wonderful. Ask me what I'm going to do when the show's over. Go ahead and ask me.
You're going to go eat, aren't you? And then you're going to go step on that scale. Make sure.
Got it. I'm going to go have a couple of hot fudge sundaes and enjoy. Hey, Connie, thank you so much for being with us. I've appreciated your time.
Thank you, Michael. We'll talk to you soon, I guess.
Yeah, good night.
All right, good night.
I got a funny feeling. We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after. They've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you.